So, as everybody knows, Bhante, Ergin, Sangharakshita died. Don't know how long ago it is, a few weeks ago now. And of course, many of us are still absorbing that. I first met Bhante when I was about 17 or 18. So I've had a lot of association with him over these years, and all sorts of memories and images and reflections have arisen since he died, and on this retreat that's no exception. And yesterday and today, what was emerging was my ordination, particularly my public ordination. Bhante, why I particularly like this image of Bhante, was wearing his yellow robes and a magnificent sort of gold and orange brocade Tibetan shirt, one of those high-collared shirts, had a special mala given to him by Mr. Chen, and long black hair, very, very tanned. It was the hot summer of 1976, the very long hot summer of 1976, on a weekend retreat in Thetford Forest in a farmhouse. And Bhante was just so inspired and so happy and so joyous. And I can remember very, very well the public ordination was ordained with Ratnaguna. I remember him announcing our names, and after he'd explained the meaning of Ratnaguna and the meaning of Padmavajra, he said a very, very beautiful thing. He said, when people say the name Ratnaguna, everybody should imagine precious jewels falling from the sky. Ratnaguna means one full of precious qualities. Brightly coloured jewels just descending down. And when people say the name Padmavajra, they should see lotuses unfolding and vajras descending. And he was so happy. He was so joyous at us too, and everybody on the retreat, but us too, committing ourselves to the three jewels, as he always was, so happy at every ordination. He was always extremely happy at ordinations. And there was one public ordination where there was a lot of people being ordained, and he was doing kesar after kesar, and he said, I could do this all day. Very, very happy. Very happy at the emergence of these new lives. And the names, of course, are the naming of the entry, the signal of the entry into a new life. So I remember that really, really clearly, his joy at our emergence, if you like. There was more to it than that. There was the solemnity of the private ordination, which was very, very deep, sort of sacred feeling in a small room in front of this beautiful, I remembered it yesterday, this beautiful Tibetan, small Tibetan Shakyamuni image that Bhante has in his collection, very old gold-leafed image. And leading study. He led study for the weekend for us on the Shepherd's Search for Mind, and tremendous emphasis in the Shepherd's Search for Mind on renunciation. Milarepa is absolutely sort of savage in his description of the perils of getting caught in samsaric life, but also very inspired in pointing out the nature of mind, the nature of ultimate bodhicitta to this young shepherd who ends up becoming one of his yogi disciples. And I was wondering, why am I having all these memories? I mean, I've had them many times before. And I was reflecting the phrase that came, this is what bodhisattvas do. This is what bodhisattvas do. They make new beings. This is what bodhisattvas do. Bhante, of course, would never claim that he was a bodhisattva. I mean, he did take the bodhisattva vows from Dada Rinpoche. He's far too modest to make any claim. But that's what bodhisattvas do. They bring into being a new new beings. They witness the emergence of new beings joyfully and happily. And I think this is very important as we do a practice, as the practice that we're doing, this incredible bodhicitta, arising of the bodhicitta practice, with this very strong feature of sending and receiving Tonglen meditation. We mustn't think that a bodhisattva is somebody who's very mournful and they're sort of weeping at the state of the world. I mean, there is that side of it. We all know very, very well what a state the world is in, but bodhisattvas are incredibly joyful. I remember the seminar on the Bodhicaryavatara where Marian Matic, who did a translation of the Bodhicaryavatara, which one of the early ones, which Bhante used for the, it's the only one really available for the endlessly fascinating cry. Matic describes the bodhisattva as reaching down into the muck and mire of phenomenality. Wonderful phrase. And Bhante said, it isn't quite like that, he said. It's not quite like that because the bodhisattva doesn't see it as muck and mire. He sees it in an entirely different way. And of course, this is, you know, just the reflection in many ways of the Buddha's own vision. You know, when the Buddha's compassion erupts under the Bodhi tree, when he looks at the world, yes, he sees a great lake, no doubt a very muddy lake, but he sees the lotuses, the red and the white and the blue lotuses. He sees beauty. He sees the emergence and the growth of living beings, and his compassion is for that. The Buddha's compassion, his anukampa, his shaking with, is for that emergence. If you like, his compassion is for, if perhaps even for, the frustrated emergence in all life. I mean, when the Buddha went forth from the Bodhi tree to communicate, what he would see in living beings, he wouldn't just see their dukkha, he would see their potentiality. He would see their potentiality emerging. You see this in the Pali Canon, that the Buddha goes into a situation and immediately, spontaneously, naturally, he can see who is ripe for the Dharma. He can see, he can direct his teaching exactly to who is ripe in that moment. You know, if a Buddha or a great bodhisattva were to come into this room, they wouldn't see us as we see one another. They would be seeing this emerging potential. That's what they would be seeing. If they particularly see dukkha, it would be the dukkha of the frustration of that, the frustration in living beings, the fundamental frustration. Sometimes people ask us, even complain, even sort of petition, you know, that for us in the Tri Ratna to do more for the world, more for the world, more activism, more for the environment, this, that, and the other. But of course, in many ways, that reflects a lack of faith in the Dharma, a lack of faith in the life of life, the life of life, the essence of life, which is the Dharma. I remember years and years ago when we were building Sukhavati, some Methodist clergymen came to see Bhante. They were very intrigued by how a group of young men had got together to convert an old fire station in the East End, which, and in the 70s, the East End was very, very bleak in those days. And they wanted to know what Buddhism had and what Sangharakshita was up to. And they had a very, very interesting conversation, and towards the end of the conversation they asked the very important question, but what are you doing for the casualties of society, the homeless, you know, the hungry, and so on and so forth, people, you know, affected by addiction and so on and so forth. And Bhante said, well, we're a new movement, so, you know, we're still in our early days. But he added, and I think this is the key point, what we're concerned with are the existential casualties. The existential casualties. And I think that's an incredible insight. There are lots of, you know, different organisations working with other casualties. But who is reaching into the hearts of living beings, of people, of human beings, reaching into their hearts, connecting with their potential for Buddhahood, connecting with that and giving them the conditions in which that can flower and grow, and which can be a ground for the transformation of the life. There are very, very few people doing that effectively. I hope we're not the only group. I'm sure we're not the only group, but there isn't much of that. And that's the life of life. That's the life of life. And, you know, Bhante's faith in the Dharma is so deep, is so profound. There's an early lecture where he's talking about if the longing, the desire, the urge to grow and develop along, you know, what he called the higher evolution, to develop as an individual, if that is blocked in some way, blocked either by yourself or by the conditions around you, it will become destructive. It won't go away. And he said, and we do notice that crime is on the increase. This is quite a long time ago, this lecture. He said, well, I'm not saying that all crime is frustrated spiritual development, but he was making a point, a really, really crucial point about the fundamental nature of life, and why the Dharma and why the Bodhisattva life is so desperately needed. We need to communicate the Dharma in its fullness more and more widely, more and more fully, more and more imaginatively than we are already. We need to do far more of that. That's what Bhante lived for. That's what he lived for. That's what he gave his whole life for, both in India and in this country. As I said, he took the Bodhisattva vow. He took the Bodhisattva vow. He trained in the Dharma, open to the Dharma, fully and completely. And when you train like that, and of course we're following him, especially on a retreat like this, in this intensive practice of bodhicitta, when you train like that, you become incredibly receptive to what is needed. The ultimate end of the Dharma life is Bhante describes, following tradition, is spontaneous compassionate activity. That's the end of the Dharma life. Spontaneous, compassionate activity. Something happens, you immediately act. You immediately act in a compassionate way. Unselfconsciously, without thinking that you're being compassionate, you immediately respond to the needs of the people in front of you. Dharmically, naturally, dharmically. You give them what they need, spontaneously. It's immediate. In other words, what we're doing in our Dharma life, and perhaps especially on a retreat like this, we're removing all of the blocks to that response. We're removing all of the attachment, all of the aversion, all of the ignorance, all of the conceit, all of the fear, to enable us to reach a position where we can respond with the Dharma immediately. Immediately. This would take more than this retreat to achieve, but that's what we're opening up to. This is what the real meaning of the Bodhisattva vow is. The Bodhisattva vows, there are lists of them, but really the Bodhisattva vow is the force of that intention to respond in that way, to respond immediately. And of course, you all know the story of Bhante in Nagpur after Dr. Ambedkar's death, having to just respond to keep the Dharma alive, to keep the liberation movement alive for the followers of Dr. Ambedkar. And I met people who were around at that time. I met one of the main translators from that time. And the way they describe Bhante is incredible, what Bhante would do, and where they would go, and how they would respond and act, how he would respond. And this is why Bhante has such a deep connection with Indian Buddhists. I mean, another man I met who was also at the conversion in Nagpur at the time of Bhante, I remember meeting, he was a politician, and a bit later on he asked Bhante to come to his district, Ahmednagar district, very poor, backward district, to communicate the Dharma. And he was in tears talking about Bhante. He said, we've never met a man like this, wearing his simple robes. He'd sleep in any place, drink any water, and it was bad water, eat any food. He'd stay with us, he'd talk to us, nothing was too much trouble. He didn't mind walking from village to village or going in a bullock cart or even going side saddle on somebody's bicycle. There were no cars or even, you know, scooters in those days. And they said, we'd never seen a man like this who was prepared to do that for us and be with us in that way. That's the teacher we have, that spontaneous response. And then, of course, coming to England in the 1960s, that incredible sort of time, that opening, if you like, and just being there and responding again and again to individuals, you know, to people generally, and out of that something happening, something emerging, opening up to something greater. You can read all about that in Bhante's memoirs. That's our teacher. That's what bodhisattvas do. They respond and they rejoice. They rejoice when they see people emerging. And of course, they'll feel real concern when people are in difficulty and, you know, they'll want to help in that way. But there is this wonderfully positive response. Somebody was asking me, you know, how I felt after Bhante died, whether I felt grief or sorrow. And I said, well, not really. I felt there were a few times of intense weeping, and I couldn't work out why I was weeping. And then I realized it was gratitude. It was intense gratitude that a great man, a truly great man, had taken a personal interest in me, had encouraged me, taken me more seriously than I'd taken myself, had given me the Dharma, enriched me with the Dharma wonderfully, and had asked for nothing in return. Just given that to me. The only demand really was that I take responsibility for myself, that I could take responsibility for myself and even take a bit of responsibility in relation to others, which was the last thing I wanted to do, both of those, any kind of responsibility. So he had me. Yes, in intense gratitude. After the day he died, we had a very lovely day here. It was very quiet here. There was no retreat going on. And the best times were just sitting together silently around the fire. And we did a puja in the evening, that evening. And I knew I had to read something. I had a text that Bhante actually reads in towards the end of the Bodhisattva Ideal lectures. I knew I had to do this reading. I didn't know why I had to do this reading. I just really wanted to do this reading. I'll read it in a moment. But it was very interesting what happened in that puja, because as the puja went on, towards the end of the puja, I had the sense of a sort of vastness. And there was a great bird disappearing into space, way up high, like a great eagle just going off into space. And I thought, oh, that must be you, Bhante. And at the same time, I felt he was inside me. I felt he was within me because of all the Dharma that he'd poured into me. Because that's what bodhisattvas do. Yes, they go, but they also leave you with so much, to enrich you, and which you hold to. There's a line I read last night in the reading from Shantideva. You who are accustomed to travelling abroad among the trading towns of the realms of rebirth, grasp tightly this jewel that is the bodhicitta. It is precious. Carefully examined and attested by the unique leaders of mankind. So we're just in a trading town. Our existence is a place where we meet and part and have exchange and communication. Hold tightly to the training. Hold tightly to the bodhicitta, which can transform you. The verse previous to this, it's described as a highly potent quicksilver elixir, which must be thoroughly worked into us to transform this base human form into the image of a Buddha jewel, a golden Buddha jewel. So that's what Bhante has done. He's been in this trading town of existence for a while, and he's given and given and given and created, and people have responded. He's created a sangha, a community. Our task now is to hold tightly to the bodhicitta so that it transforms us and the world around us. So over the rest of the retreat, really come back to that. Unite more and more with the force of bodhicitta, more and more with that. What happens after the retreat, you don't need to think about. But the aim is to turn yourself into a man who can respond with spontaneous compassion to whatever arises. That's our aim. But I'll end with the verse, though, the verses that I read before that puja. It's verses from a Tibetan sadhana called the Confounder of Hell, a Vajrasattva sadhana. And I'm ending them with them because, in a way, it described the paradoxes, perhaps, that I was feeling of Bhante vanishing and yet being present. He describes in the Bodhisattva Ideal Lecture Series, Bhante, that the Bodhisattva is the living contradiction. The living contradiction. He's in the world, but he's not of the world. He's in nirvana, he's in samsara. He is masculine, he is feminine. He is active, he is a meditator. He is devotional, he can be a scholar. All of these things are united in the Bodhisattva. So listen to these verses, and this will be the end of the talk. Emao, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones. Within the birthless, all things take their birth, yet in that birth, nothing is born. Emao, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones. Within the ceaseless, all things cease to be, yet in that ceasing, nothing ceases. Emao, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones. Within the non-abiding, all abides, yet thus abiding, nothing abides. Emao, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones. In non-perception, everything is perceived, yet this perceiving is quite perceptionless. Emao, Dharma wondrous strange, profoundest mystery of the perfect ones. In the unmoving, all things come and go, yet in that movement, nothing ever moves.
Thank you so much.